Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. Now, since the dawn of time, the greatest structures, monuments, and other mighty works of mankind have been celebrated as wonders of the world. And like seas, days of the week, and deadly sins, there are always seven of them. In ancient times, the seven wonders featured hanging gardens, a couple of large statues, a great pyramid, and a lighthouse. A more modern list of wonders includes the Empire State Building, the Taj Mahal, and the Great Wall of China. And then there are the seven natural wonders, such as the Great Barrier Reef in Australia and the Grand Canyon in America, and so on. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? Well, that's the question I ask my guests in this podcast. And the person I'm asking today is the archaeologist and anthropologist, broadcaster and writer, Mary-Ann Ohota. For the last few years, Mary-Ann has presented or co-presented a whole range of television programmes, such as Time Team with Tony Robinson on Channel 4, Britain's Secret Treasures and Britain's Secret Homes on ITV. Her latest book is called Secret Britain. So obviously there's always a good chance of learning something new, surprising or covered up when Mary-Ann is on the case. Mary-Ann has also explored Britain's puzzling history and prehistory in a couple of excellent series for the Smithsonian Channel called Mystic Britain. On these, she's been helped or hampered by presenting the series alongside me. But Mary-Ann, we can come to our winter months exploring damp bits of Britain, uncovering old bones and ruined buildings. I know that's all bread and butter to you. I'm fascinated to discover, though, what you regard as wonders. In fact, I was half expecting this to be entirely made up of archaeological sites you visited in Britain, with or indeed without me. But you're a bit more wide-ranging than that, aren't you?
Well, I tried to keep it in check, Clive, because I could definitely spend about a week talking about all the wonders, not just seven, all of the wonders of Britain's magical past. But I've tried to broaden my and your horizons with this list.
Well, you're certainly going to do that. But I will ask you, if I may, in due course, as to what first attracted you to the wonders of British archaeology. But I think your first wonder takes us beyond the seas.
Yes, that's right. So my first wonder is the Taj Mahal. So it's kind of pretty common or garden on lists of wonders. I think it was on the list of new wonders that was proposed and ratified by the world a few years ago. This extraordinary masterpiece of Mughal architecture on the banks of the River Yamuna in Agra in India. But for me, it isn't because it's this amazing, you know, testament to human ingenuity, creativity, religious zeal, love for your wife, all the rest of it, blah, blah, blah. For me, it was the place that I had a really nice mango ice cream at the age of 5.
Oh, right. Well, I will perhaps do more than just the ice cream. But I wonder what you do make of something like this at the age of 5. I mean, I suppose almost everybody's heard of the Taj Mahal. I have to admit, I haven't been there. And I thought I'd better just check exactly where it was. So I looked up, you know, Taj Mahal map, and I put that into my, you know, search engine, and it came up with all the Indian restaurants in London, which happened to be called Taj Mahal. But so you were taken to India as a child. Was this a holiday or a family jaunt or what?
So my mum and her family are Indian, and she grew up in Bombay, as it was then, Mumbai now. So I think regularly my life growing up has been punctuated by visits to India and going to see family, but also, you know, traveling a bit more widely, sometimes with the family from India, because it's an opportunity for everyone to have a holiday. And I think that's definitely that fostered a love and interest in all the different myriad ways that people can live their lives and to sort of see beyond what would have otherwise been sort of lower middle class, perfectly reasonable and not particularly interesting, childhood in Cheshire. going to a perfectly normal school and doing all the rest of the things that all my other classmates were doing. But instead of going to Lanzarote and coming back with necklaces with those sweeties on that, you know, all the girls in my class would distribute as kind of tokens of affiliation with their friends, I'd be taken off on a holiday to India and I wouldn't have much to show for it.
Well, there's things you can bring back from India. So your mother's from India, and I think your father's Polish, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So his family came to Britain after the war. So his parents came here after the war. So I think definitely sort of having different perspectives, different languages, different cultures, and then finding those commonalities between them, that's definitely shaped, I guess, my perspective. But yeah.
So you didn't really like... you didn't especially like the Taj Mahal, but it. But
no,
do you think
I saw the ancient rock-cut caves of Ajanta and Ellora. Meh, wasn't bothered. I mean, I've been since, and it's amazing.
Did the Taj Mahal anyway nudge you towards being interested in historical things? I suppose in terms of the things you often study, Taj Mahal's quite recent. I mean, you're more sort of prehistory rather than. I mean, that's only a few centuries ago. Taj Mahal.
The paint is barely dry. I think it probably did, because I think there's, you know what it does? It establishes very early on the idea that these are places that are open to you, that you are entitled to visit and spend time at. And I think that's really crucial, because I think some families growing up, it's perfectly normal to go to museums and galleries and historic sites and have memberships to this, that and the other kind of, you know, historic society or what have you. And then for other families, it isn't. And it just feels alien and a thing that other people do. And so I think that going to these sites when you can't really remember them or the only thing you do remember is getting a balloon or a fridge magnet or something like that, I think they are valuable. I think they just embed in you an idea that this is your heritage on whatever, either abstract or you know, tenuous level, that it's yours to be explored as and when you choose to.
A land that is filled with wondrous tales of rajas and sultans and their beautiful queens. The most enchanting of them all takes place here by the shimmering Yamuna River. It's about a dashing young emperor, his beautiful princess, and amazing monument. The Taj Mahal. This is a love story.
All right. Well, I want to move you on to your second wonder, because that does fit in with the theme as you've started with a couple of ancient, and this is a more ancient site, though, isn't it? Number two. How do you pronounce it? Kalanish?
Kalanish. Well, Kalanish. I pronounce it Kalanish. Yeah. I don't know what the Gaelic... Is it Gaelic?
Gaelic in the west of Scotland, yeah.
Okay. Well, there we go. I mean, it's a good start, isn't it? Okay, so
tell us what they are. Tell us what they're, because you do know all about them.
I do. Okay, so Kalanish is this extraordinary site. It's on a promontory on the Isle of Lewis, which is one of the islands of the Outer Hebrides. And the Outer Hebrides are off on the northwest coast of Scotland, sort of beyond Skye. They're on the way to St Kilda, which is on the way to America or Greenland. And they're kind of really remote. Have you ever been, Clive?
I have, yes. So they're a little bit like Stonehenge. They're standing stones arranged in a circle and a pattern. But is that a bit Philistine of me to say it's like Stonehenge? They're probably very different to your mind.
No, I think they are like Stonehenge. I think you're absolutely right. And I think that if Kalanish, So Kalanish 1 is the kind of the centrepiece, which is a stone circle, as you describe, with a central monolith, which is absolutely enormous. It's about 5 metres high. And then radiating out to the cardinal points are lines of stones. So single lines of stones to the south, the east and the west, and then a paired avenue of stones that goes out towards the north. And I think you're absolutely right to sort of say it's a bit like Stonehenge, because it is a bit like Stonehenge. If it were closer to London or a major airport, as many people would visit it as Stonehenge, because it's remarkable. It's really compelling. And often when you go, you're one of a handful of other people visiting.
Well, I mean, it sort of applies to Stonehenge as well, but it certainly applies to these sort of sites on Lewis or Orkney or Scotland generally. They appear to be very remote places, and you can scarcely imagine people eking out a living in prehistoric times, let alone having the resources to build something like this for whatever reason they built. And do we know why Callanish was built, or is it?
It's the eternal question of why. Well, I think so. The dating for Callanish 1 is something between 2600 2900 BC. So it makes it a little bit older than Stonehenge. The stone settings that we see at Stonehenge now, you know, the lintels, the circle with the stones sitting up on top, they date from about 2500 BC. But across this period, which is the end of the Stone Age, the late Neolithic, the weather was slightly better. So those kind of Hebridean landscapes that we imagine now, where there's a thick layer of peat and there's a, you know, you can sustain a few cows that manage to kind of not get their feet too wet as the waters rise. It wasn't really like that in the late Neolithic. It was more more fertile landscape, so that they could farm and they would have had surplus. But of course,
that's
fantastic. You're right.
That's so typical. I go to Scotland a lot, and it's usually raining. But people there say, "Oh, you should have been here last week. It was beautiful last week." So so in these terms, you know, you can go there now and say, "Well, it's a bit peaty and damp and windswept." Oh, you should have been here 5,000 years ago. Yeah. It was fantastic then.
It was great. Loads of shellfish. Yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. You know, local produce, all very seasonal. Yeah.
But what draws you to this sort of thing? Because this has become your career, really, studying. It could be old bones that have been dug up. It can be stones which have been erected for reasons which we can only really speculate about. What was it? Were you always interested in this, or was it a flash of inspiration when you were, you know, filling in your form to go to university? Oh, archaeology and anthropology. I'll try that. That you know, nobody else is doing that. What was the motivation?
So I studied archaeology and anthropology at university, and I had in my mind from being a sort of 14-year-old that I wanted to go to Cambridge, and I don't know why particularly that got into my head. And I had enough sort of academic chops that wasn't totally out of the ballpark. And I think probably having that cross-cultural heritage and then being interested in people, for a long time I wanted to be a vet because I do like animals, but then I realised that most of the time you spend kind of, you know, dealing with overweight cats or, you know, castrating puppies or what have
or
you.
Or putting them down when they're old.
Yeah,
which is
that's
a bit
true.
Depressing.
A bit depressing.
For all concerned, yeah.
And the thing that I realised that I particularly liked about veterinary medicine wasn't the kind of the science behind the drugs or anything like that. It was the kind of the interactions between people and animals. And I thought, and then, you know, as you do when you're a teenager and you think that you've kind of got, you know, the world is your oyster intellectually and, you know, physically. I kind of thought, oh, well, no, that's very fascinating. I wonder if people have always had that same relationship with animals, blah, 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 and realised that was actually probably anthropology rather than veterinary science.
Yes.
So but then I had to study archaeology and anthropology together as a joint degree in order to go to Cambridge. They've actually changed the degree course now, so you don't have to study archaeology. So it was kind of an accident because I wasn't that fussed about archaeology. I thought I found it interesting, but I wouldn't have selected it as a degree.
We've strayed a bit away from the standing stones, but you asked if I'd been there, and I have, and a friend of mine has also been there, and he can't stay there. He gets a sort of like an electric charge off, and that's the best way I can describe it, off these stones. And he's not someone prone to, you know, that sort of sensitive feeling about most things, but he generally finds it too disturbing. So goodness only knows what sort of stones and why they are arranged. But
I think it is an extraordinary place. The best guess, but based on the archaeological research that's been done, which is quite extensive now at Callanish, it does appear to be an observatory or a temple that is particularly aligned to movements of the moon. And one of the most compelling alignments is, bear with me, Clive, I know you're a rationalist, is the point at which the moon is lowest in the sky, a full moon, which happens every 18.6 years. And that sounds, I mean, it does sound bonkers, the very idea that a bunch of you know, subsistence farmers at the far edge of the northwest of Scotland, A, have the time and resources to build this massive stone monument, but also to align it perfectly to something that happens once every evening, every two decades or so. Because it's, you know, it's not always sunny up there.
No, but apparently that a lot of effort to be... for just spotting where the moon's going to be every couple of decades.
But I kind of guess, I think that probably means that they were worshipping the moon in some way, or the moon is a kind of a cipher or a representative of the gods or the goddesses. And so it's not just the moon. You know, it's like, oh, yep, there's the moon where we thought it was going to be. But it's something about the moon visiting Earth. And there's really intriguing... clues in actual classical documents where there's descriptions of the Hyperboreans, who are this race of distant people who live beyond the North Wind, and they have a sacred precinct aligned or kind of in honour or worship of the moon. And you kind of go, oh, could they be describing Callanish? Could there have been travellers in the ancient lands who heard about this place or knew about this place while sailing around the coast and went, ooh, these are the Hyperboreans. These are the people who live beyond the North Wind.
Yeah, I suppose the great thing about archaeology is you never quite get to a final answer, do you? Because there's always a chance that some new way of analysing the material might blow your theory out of the water. And even if that doesn't come along, there's always room for another theory when something else can be factored in.
I think that's true. But I think the thing about archaeology as well is that it doesn't lie in the way that historical documents lie, because, you know, history is always written with an angle, with an edge. Whereas the archaeology, when you kind of strip it back to the data, no one's making that up. There's no critique to it. And so everyone's starting with the same raw material. And then you can analyse and interpret and then critique and kind of interrogate that analysis equally.
It is, of course, the rocks below, which give the island's countryside its special character. These are the oldest rocks in Britain, and during the Ice Age, huge glaciers pushed over them, grinding away their surface and leaving behind in places a layer of clay. On this better soil, you find small farms or crofts.
So, having mentioned some animals, let's go on to your wonder number three. What's that?
That is dogs. Now, I think dogs truly are, and you're a dog fan as well, aren't you?
I am, yes, yeah.
Dogs are truly one of the wonders of the world. You know, they've been, we've evolved with them. They're one of the earliest domesticates. But specifically, I absolutely love my dog, and he makes my life much, much better. And I think that he's generally in the, I apologise to all the people he's stolen sandwiches from or kind of slobbered over the years. But he's generally a force for good in the world. And he's quite elderly now. So
What sort of dog is he, and what's he called?
So he's a chocolate Labrador. He's called Harpo. He's now 11 and a bit, and he's a bit dodgery, and bits of him are falling off and all the rest of it.
Why is he called Harpo? Was that because you wanted a quiet dog, so you went for the silent Marx brother to give him his name?
He is named after the silent Marx brother. We got him as a rescue at about 10 months, and he was wild, he was a right silly Billy. The people who had him before, I think, got a cute brown puppy, you know, kind of a brown version of the Andrex puppy. And then it turned into this enormous, you know, 35 kilo, young adult, athletic, full of energy dog. And they didn't quite realise how much effort and energy that and time that takes up. So they realised they needed to rehome him. So we got him when he was kind of a wayward adolescent who just had worked out that he was quite big and quite smart. And if he moved fast enough, then he could mostly outfox the humans that he'd been in contact with. So I've been watching The Dog Whisperer, you know, that TV show with Cesar Millan, and kind of going, oh, I can do this. I'm at one with the animal kingdom, thinking that it would there'd be some kind of miraculous transformation of this dog from, you know, mad dog to Harpo, friendly and kind of amusing, you know, comically and charming, you know, a physical comic. It probably took about a year, I think, for him to really, you know, get with the programme, to sign up.
I think they are a bit, chocolate Labradors, I think are a bit, because Labradors are quite compliant dogs, but I think the chocolate element, the way they had to get that, I think that made them a bit madder.
So well, they say that, but I think someone else told me that in Labrador litters of puppies, you get all three colours, and it's just a kind of a quirk of, you know, whether you've got blue eyes or green eyes or brown eyes or hazel eyes. So that the poor old brown ones, you're just being racist, Clive, is what you're being, dog racist.
I hope not. But I thought that I thought they brought in like Doberman genes or something like that to bring in the brown colour. But
I don't think so. No, yeah. I think they're kind of I think there's just a it's a, like it's like Revels, isn't it? You don't know which one you're going to get.
Anyway, you obviously like, you know, Harpo and dogs generally, and of course it does link in with your archaeological career. As you say, the dogs have been with humans for thousands of years, tens of thousands of years, the first animal domesticated. You can find buried puppies, buried adult dogs with people. So they've been, humans and dogs have been close together for a long time.
Yeah, there's another site in my new book, Secret Britain, a site called Must Farm, which is in Cambridgeshire. And it's this extraordinary site from the Bronze Age. And just because of a quirk of the preservation, because it's quite a waterlogged area, all the organic material has survived. And what it appears to be is a sort of some kind of disaster where these wooden roundhouses have burned down and collapsed on the spot that they were standing. But inside the houses were all the household utensils, the weapons, all the kind of the day-to-day stuff. There were intact pottery vessels still with people's porridge in them that has all just been preserved because it was burned and then dropped into this kind of waterlogged landscape. And then nothing was salvaged. So we don't really know what happened to the people. But one of the things they discovered in Must Farm were Bronze Age dog poos. So they knew they had dogs. And from studying these coprolites, that's the posh word, but studying the dog poo, they discovered that the dogs were eating the same food as the humans. So they were probably being fed table scraps, which I think is lovely. The very idea that Harpo begging for scraps from our table is you know, fundamentally an ancestral rite of his.
Yes, part of the tradition. And it does have a hint to the clue of the glamour of archaeology, that a study is made of dog poo from an ancient site to work out what was being fed.
Yeah, it's not all frescoes and mosaics. Yeah, a lot of it is shit. Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
OK, Marion, let's move on to number four, which I suppose shouldn't come close to dog in the list, but it does. So let's do it now. Number four.
So number four is Cadbury's Fruit and Nut. It has to specifically be a 200 gram bar, please. You know, one of those big bars, not a little bar. That doesn't count.
I say it shouldn't come close together because for some reason, dogs aren't supposed to have chocolates, alleged to be very poisonous to them. I must say that my dog frequently manages to get his hand or his mouth on chocolate and has survived pretty well so far.
I think it gives them liver poisoning or something. I think it is quite bad.
Yeah, well, he's more than 15
whatever,
years old,
it's
so
fine.
It hasn't knocked him. He's had to come through a few Easters, you know, where there's too much chocolate lying around. Anyway, so Cadbury's Fruit and Nut. Now, why fruit and nut? Is that you want a bit of health with your chocolate, the fruit and nut, or
no? I mean, that would be stretching, wouldn't it? No, Cadbury's Fruit and Nut is reliably sweet and uncomplicated in its palate. You don't get tasting notes, do you, with a Cadbury's Fruit and Nut? Like this fancy single origin, you know, handmade chocolate stuff. My husband's really into really posh chocolate. He's got a chocolate subscription by some chocolate artisan. And I'm just not, I just can't be bothered with it because it's about £7 for a bar. And I'm like, I just, a bar of Cadbury's Fruit and Nut will do me fine. And it's the thing that I take on adventures or expeditions with me. That's my little treat that I know tastes like home. It's a very grounding, visceral experience for me eating Cadbury's Fruit and Nut.
That's a very interesting. I wondered why Cadbury's Fruit and Nut was appearing. And it's interesting that your husband has an interest in more, I know, refined chocolate, more, you know, and you're fighting against that.
He's quite a fancy man. I mean, he's very well dressed. He's sure got all these. I mean, basically, what is described in our chocolate preferences, it follows through in many other elements of our life together. So he's got lots of fancy face cream, for example, and I've got like a tub of the stuff that was most recently on offer in the supermarket.
Okay. So you met at Cambridge, I think.
Yes, we did. Yeah, so we met in the first week at in the bar at Emmanuel College. So we both went to Emmanuel College, which was...
Was he an archaeologist, an anthropologist as well?
No, he's a philosopher, which I think that he probably thinks he is as well still. So he's now a writer. But yeah, so he studied philosophy and I studied archaeology. And we had rooms on adjoining staircases in the student halls. And he was on the ground floor and he always had his windows open. He always had the lights on all day and all night. So his kind of room became the kind of hangout room. So we got chatting.
And you're still hanging out with him.
Yeah, I know. all these years later, 21 years later.
Yes.
Isn't that extraordinary? I don't understand how I'm that old, I'll be honest. It's a miracle.
Well, obviously, these time estimates are just estimates in the world.
They are, they are. Yeah, there's standard deviations to account for. And I am obviously aiming for a kind of a white marble mausoleum on the banks of a river. As his favourite wife so far.
But it sounds like he'd get away with just commemorating you with some, let's say, and I don't, this is a put down, as cheap chocolate can be used rather than having to invest in.
Yeah, but once I'm dead, I can't eat the chocolate, so he needs to step up the game. Yeah.
Well, I know you've got a child and you've told us about your dog and you've got a husband. And now with this, so obviously it's useful having a child in the sense you can justify getting in massive quantities of Cadbury's Fruit and Nut or any other chocolate like that.
So the danger is though that I would probably take it from the hands of the baby, because once there's chocolate, it's very hard for me to not eat it all. So I have to be kind of more discerning about when it comes into my possession, because once it's in my possession, the whole 200 gram bar will go pretty quick. I remember. So I sailed across the North Pacific. I was media crew, so I kind of joined as a writer, joining the Clip Around the World Yacht Race. And so we were sailing from Qingdao in China to the coast of San Francisco, California. So it's about 6,000 miles, just over 6,000 miles, that we sailed over 30 days at sea, and it's very, very rough and very, very cold. And there is, you know, genuine objective risk that you might die. And I remember there was one particular night where it had been a very difficult shift where we'd had to do sail changes and we got smashed about and we were dripping wet and there was no hope of warm or dry clothes for the next 2 weeks at least. And I thought, well, gosh, if I die now, I don't want there to be chocolate left over. And so at the end of our watch on, actually sailing, you kind of clamber down into the bowels of this stripped down racing yacht. And I sat on top of these sodden wet sails and it felt about 3 degrees and you're kind of slowly steaming some of your base layers dry. And I ate all my chocolate because I thought, if I'm going to die, I want to have eaten this chocolate. Thank you very much.
So people have a bucket list of things they've got to do. Your bucket is just filled up with chocolate.
I did it though. And then didn't die, so there we go.
There were just a couple of hundred employees when the firm first came to the River Bourne. Now there are about 8,000 in and among the acres of specialised buildings and thousands more at the Cadbury factories in different parts of the British Commonwealth. For this is what you might call a combined operation. Factories within a factory. One must keep pace with the other. The sequence of production must be strictly governed to avoid bottlenecks. A pile-up of chocolates, for instance, all wrapped up and nowhere to go.
Telling me about that neatly takes us into your next wonder, which will lead us into some pointers towards the gung-ho side of your character and just how exciting your lifestyle is, having mentioned sailing the Pacific. But what's your fifth wonder?
So number five is the Inaccessible Pinnacle, which is this extraordinary pinnacle of rock on the part of the Black Coulin on the Isle of Skye, again, off the northwest coast of Scotland. It's just accident that those two things are the Inn Pin and Callanish are sort of near each other.
Yeah, so that's the abbreviation for Inn Pin. And this is the Coulins, which are, I suppose, people know by name, or they may have seen, or they may have walked along the Coulins in Skye. But now, the clue to this particular bit of it, though, it's called the Inaccessible Pinnacle. So that's a warning to anybody who cares to take it. There's really not a place to try and get onto, but you've been on it.
It was absolute hubris. And the challenge of the name. So the Inaccessible Pinnacle, although it being called the Inaccessible Pinnacle, is, it turns out, Clive, accessible. With someone such as myself, with a guide and a rope, elite climbers who have a very, very strong head for heights, would I guess be able to climb up it? If you let go, you die. So, or if you slip, you die. So, you know, those are the terms upon which you kind of attempt to access said pinnacle. It was first climbed in 1880, when climbing was just becoming a thing.
Yeah.
And two kind of bright young mountaineering hopes got a local shepherd to help them climb up.
So the people like going climbing in Scotland, and they like to go on things called the Munros, which are all the mountain tops, which are, is it 3,000 feet you've got to be up?
Yes, that's right. So the Inn Pin is one of the Munros. So that's one of the reasons that people try and scale this kind of jagged tooth of rock. And you kind of climb up the east face, which is sort of stepped, I guess, and it gets narrower and narrower. So then your hands are overlapping. And if you look down, you can just see, oh, God, it goes down and down and down. It's like Mordor. You know, you're just looking into the depths of this kind of the rocky jaws of hell itself.
Wait a minute.
And then you abseil off the other side.
Yeah, no, look, I understand the people who are determined to do these things and they want to bag every Munro. They've got to do this. Why did you want to do it? Because I know it fits in with your lifestyle. You take a lot of risks and very full of daring do. But what made you want to climb this particular peak?
So specifically, I'm a hillwalking ambassador for the British Mountaineering Council, and they are most known for representing climbers. So they represent the Olympic climbing side of things that's going to the Olympics next year, and obviously mountaineers, but they also represent hillwalkers. And I got involved with them as a perfectly normal person who likes hill walking, who happens to also be on TV. And so, you know, there's a bit of profile there. And the guy that I work with quite closely at the BMC, this chap called Alex, he phoned me up and he said, Marianne, we want to make a short film about climbing the Inn Pin, because lots of people want to do it. It's one of those bucket list challenges for climbers and mountaineers and walkers. But we can't send one of our climbing ambassadors because they'll make it look too easy. So we're going to send you because you'll make it look hard.
Well, look, I've seen you do it. I've seen the film. You put on a display of a bit sort of, oh, I'm not sure if I can manage this. But I
know you. Oh, no, I was genuinely scared.
You just were trotting along there, hardly noticing the fact you might plunge to your death at any moment.
No, this one, Clive, I really was very, very aware of the fact that I might plunge to my death. And even though I was climbing up second, so I had this amazing guide, woman called Louisa Reynolds, who's a mountaineering instructor, and she's, you know, not quite half my height. She's, you know, 5 foot something, and she's pretty and blonde and supremely friendly. And I think for a lot of, and she's an amazing mountaineer. She's an amazing instructor, and she's done extraordinary climbing in her under her own name. And the thing that really struck me was that, you know, we're two women, and if it's quite easy, I think, when, you know, she's kind of putting all the rack of the kit together and sorting out the ropes and all the rest of it, and I'm standing there twiddling my thumbs, feeling very, very nervous, too nervous to eat breakfast. I thought, God, it'd be really easy to underestimate her, because she just doesn't look like any of the stereotypes of what a climber or a mountaineer looks like. But she's absolutely hard as nails. And the thing that really struck me as two women out in the mountains was that it's one of those opportunities, and I think they're not that easy to come by. It's those opportunities where how you look doesn't matter at all. It's about your body, is about what you do with it. Your body is about a tool to achieve achieve an objective. It's not about looking nice. And
well,
I thought
I'd have to say, as far
uplifting.
As bodies are concerned, some tools are better than others. and of course, I think the danger in that film, with the, as you say, two women doing it, there's a certain type of man who might be looking at it saying, oh, two women, I'll do it, no bother, putting on a pair of trainers and a, you know, a stout pair of jeans, and they'll be lured to their deaths because they won't have planned it properly.
Well, that'll teach him. That'll serve him his own comeuppance. But I think what I would want it to do was for a woman out there, perhaps, or a chap who isn't, you know, the idiot you've just described, going, oh God, I don't know if I could do it. I don't. Oh, that's not for people like me. And you go, well, look, I can do it. And I'm what was I? You know, I'm the girl in the Tesco's vest. I can do it. You know, with a guide, do it properly. Don't just go up in your, you know, your best trainers. No, don't do that.
I think there's a certain one viewer of the that film would go, oh, that's very interesting and it's very well done, but no force on earth is going to get me to try that.
Well, that's okay. Power is knowledge.
Because yeah. When we were filming together yeah. for the Smithsonian program, there were a few bits of things that involved abseiling down things or climbing things. And I noticed you were allocated those because everyone had plenty of faith in you because you do so many different things. There's that bit of if you call that mountaineering and walking down there. You've already told us about sailing the Pacific in what sounds like very hairy circumstances. You dive as well, don't you?
I do, yes. So I really like scuba diving. I haven't actually done it. I was thinking about this the other day. So since lockdown, diving is feasible as an organised activity or what have you. But I obviously stopped diving when I became pregnant with Cole, my son, who's now two, and just I need to kind of refresh my skills because it's one of those things where if you're not absolutely tip-top on your skills, you might kill yourself or your buddy. But the thing that I really enjoy scuba diving is in Britain. So I'm not really one for kind of exotic tropical holidays. Partly, I think, as a jobbing freelancer in the, you know, previous 10 years, I haven't had that much money, I guess, to kind of go on exotic foreign holidays for weeks at a time, kind of diving beautiful tropical reefs. But I have managed to kind of a weekend in Plymouth. And the diving around the UK, it's absolutely amazing. You need a lot more kit and you do have to kind of tolerate the suffering a bit more, I think, because you kind of get cold. But I don't mind suffering. For a good outcome, I don't mind a bit of suffering.
But you're obviously a very dynamic person and, you know, you do enjoy, you know, that thrill of the fear or the danger or pushing yourself to the limit in these different, I mean, I there may be other areas that I'm just not aware of, but, you know, diving and there's swimming, there's climbing, you know, there's quite a few things you're quite prepared to go to the edge on.
I think I don't particularly like being scared, no. And I don't do things that that are risky for the sake of the risk. I'm not kind of hungry for that experience. But I think it's really easy, isn't it, to kind of just be very comfortable and safe and a bit beige with your experiences. And I think that's the thing that I kind of get itchy feet if I'm not doing something that offers me the chance to experience something new or learn something about myself or just kind of strip back the comfort a bit so that it's a bit more immediate, I guess.
This has given me a taste of British mountaineering. It's blurred the lines between walking and scrambling and climbing. And I've realised just how much there is still to explore, so many more routes to do, so many more skills to practice. I'm hooked. I'll be back.
Let's do your sixth wonder.
Sixth wonder. And we're getting carried away, aren't we? Sixth wonder is a village in the Democratic Republic of Congo called Mwandiga Twa.
So what were you doing there? You must have been either abseiling in or climbing a mountain there or walking up the river, paddling down the river.
I'd gone to see some of the work that a charity called Toilet Twinning had been doing there.
Toilet twinning.
So the idea of toilet twinning is that you can twin your toilet with a toilet somewhere in the developing world, and it is part of the solution to funding what is effectively a global sanitation disaster. Because we've still got about 2.5 billion people who have nowhere to go to the toilet. And that means kind of nowhere safe, nowhere where the waste stays away from them. So they're not going to get sick. Their little ones aren't going to die. Elderly people aren't going to get ill, all the rest of it. And so it's kind of quite a fun idea. And I came across it because I was doing a talk at a school, and in the staff toilets, there was a little certificate saying, this toilet has been twinned with a toilet in, and it was a toilet in Bangladesh. And I was like, oh, this is such a good idea, because it kind of reminds you to appreciate the fact that, you know, you've taken the fact of the toilet and the loo roll and the hand basin and the soap where you can wash your hands. You take it for granted. We flush and we forget. But actually, most people don't have that. A lot of people don't have that luxury, that privilege. And so I found out about it. So I'm an ambassador for the charity now. And they said, do you want to come and see the work that we're doing in the DRC? And I said, yes, I do. Partly because I was like, how else would I ever get to visit the DRC? And partly because I wanted to find out and see more of the work that they were doing. And it's an extraordinary place.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it's a big country, the DRC, was the Belgian Congo and had a very unhappy colonial history. But is it something like 100 million people live there? So it's really quite a big place.
It's absolutely vast. And yes, it's got a very unhappy colonial history. It was one of the most brutally managed colonial lands. Absolutely, you know, disgusting. But the problems of the DRC continue. It's such a fertile land. It's beautiful. It should be a Garden of Eden. I mean, the land is fertile enough that you could have two full harvests. And it's the one place in the world, I've travelled quite extensively, it's the one place in the world where I felt more than anywhere else guilty about eating, because the people that I was filming with were hungry and would remain hungry. And, you know, the kind of the things, the images that you normally associate with, you know, Live Aid, pot-bellied children with no shoes and not many clothes and not much. Well, I was going to say not much hope, but that's the thing that's remarkable about the DRC. And that's why it's on my list of wonders, because despite all the insults, and they're all human made disasters that befall these people who are living in the DRC, who have been displaced internally, who have been refugees, who have witnessed some of the most barbaric treatment by their own leaders and, you know, invaders, they still have extraordinary hope. And the ladies that I was talking to and interviewing have formed this health club in their village, Mwandiga Twa, which is the third Mwandiga. And it used to be this patch of forest, and they're all repatriated refugees from Tanzania, and they were originally from somewhere else in the DRC, and they fled during the conflict, and then they've come back, and they're going, okay, here's your plot, it's currently you know, forest, good luck with that. Here's a machete, here's a bucket, off you go, you know, sink or swim. And the ladies in Wandigatois said, you know, we don't have much, but we've got each other. And the thing that's important is that we teach our children these skills so that they can live healthier lives than we have. And it was just mind-blowing, so humbling to see people who live in such extraordinary, perilous circumstances because of geopolitical, you know, conflicts that's far beyond their control. They're like, this is the one thing we can do. We can teach our kids to wash their hands and we can dig toilets for each other. So they go round as a gang and they dig toilets because it's much easier to do it as a group than one individual.
Well, I mean, that's very moving. But just remind me how, or remind us, if I imagine scores of listeners listening in, where will we go to find out about the toilet twinning charity that you...
Go to toilettwinning.org and you can twin your toilet and you can also twin a tap, because obviously the global pandemic means that more and more people are aware that they need to be able to wash their hands, and you can't wash your hands if you don't have a tap. So you can twin your toilet, you can twin your tap, and you can twin your bin as well.
That was your sixth wonder, and a very interesting one it was indeed. What's your seventh and last wonder?
So my seventh and last wonder is generally the city of Florence, but specifically a small photo booth that is next to the Accademia. So the Accademia is this, you know, amazing, famous gallery with Michelangelo's David in it. But next to it is a bit of a crappy photo booth.
Now, just pause before I understand this. So you're in Florence.
Yeah.
And there are quite a lot of potential wonders there. You might have had the whole of the Uffizi, or as you say, David by Michelangelo. Or there's various bridges, galleries.
Yeah, you can, basically,
you're going for a photo.
Yeah, you go around the corner anywhere in Florence and you go, whoa. It's either, you know, an extraordinary bit of Roman architecture or some amazing piece of, you know, the Renaissance. And this photo gallery, because I went on holiday with Joe, my husband, and we don't often manage to go on holiday generally or together specifically, because I travel quite a lot with work, and so going on holiday generally involves kind of staying at home and doing the garden or something like that. So we went on holiday and we had 5 days in Florence, and I'm always quite jealous of couples or families who have the presence of mind to have one of those beautiful sort of framed photo things on the wall where there's a photo from every year of their lives together. Or like, this is the first day, the first 100 days of our child's life. And they've taken a lovely kind of charismatic photo that captures some essence of their life together. We've never managed to do that. We kind of go, oh yeah, that'd be a good idea, and then don't. Or we've got like a crap photo on someone's phone or an unprocessed roll of film somewhere festering away in a dusty box in the loft. So this one trip to Florence, we had 5 days, and we said, there was this photo booth right outside the hotel we were staying. We went, let's take a photo, strip of photos every day that we're on holiday here. And we've got it framed. And when we bought our first house, we put it on the wall as you walk in. So it's kind of the thing that establishes the warmth of our house, our home. And I'm rather proud of us, because I mean, basically it means that we don't have any photos of amazing Florence. We have instead got 5 strip photos of me and Joe gurning like idiots. But I think it's partly two fingers up to the perfect Instagram life, and it also captures something of us, I think, that we were more entertained by our own faces than we were by the Renaissance.
And have you sort of extended this idea? Do you go to, you know, anywhere in the world, or you happen to be together, to find a photo booth and have a photograph? Because you're right, though, people are more interested in photographs of you than in your photograph of David.
Because
you can get a better photograph of David, but only you can really supply the photograph of you.
It's true. It's true. And I mean, we both love this. We love this thing. I think it's the thing that, you know, if the house were on fire, I'd grab the baby, the dog and that photo. In that order, for the record. In that
and
order.
And your husband.
Oh, no, he's already outside. He's going, come on, what are you waiting for? I'm outside with my chocolate and my face cream.
Oh, no, Bess, you don't need him because you've got the photographs to remember him.
Well, exactly. But if we had the presence of mind to find a photo booth in all the places we go to, then we'd be that family that I'm jealous of, or that couple that I'm jealous of. No, we've only ever managed to do it once in 20 years of being together. And that's why it's special.
Well, that in its way is as romantic as building, you know, £1 million mausoleum for the one who goes first. Thank you very much, Marianne, for giving an insight into your interests in life with your various wonders, the seven wonders of the world. I generally tried to select one of the wonders, and I thought I was going to select Calanish because that's a wonder, and also it does reflect something of you and your interest in archaeology and in British archaeology in particular. But I think with your story about the village in the Congo, I'm not sure anybody else that I interview for this series of interviews is likely to have a village in the Congo. And perhaps there's the twinned loo. Your loo and the loo twinned in that village is the aspect of that I think I should hang on to. As the wonder of the world that you've brought to the wonders that we're thinking about. I hope you feel that represents you well enough.
I think that's a perfect selection. It really does.
All right. And unfortunately, it doesn't represent your wider, your just sort of everyday interests in the archaeology of Britain and the sites that we can find in Scotland, England, everywhere else. But to find that out, people can look at your book, Secret Britain, or indeed watch the television programmes you make with sometimes incompetent co-presenters. But thank you for joining me on this podcast.
It's been absolutely a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is a Stakhanov production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.